This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A task force in Kalamazoo County is due to report soon on a proposal for a local ID card. Coming up, a rebroadcast of an interview from earlier this year, Sevilla Mann talks with the CEO of one of the groups involved in Washtenaw County's ID program. But first, we talk with State Senator Margaret O'Brien about legislation proposed by the Kalamazoo County Republican, the state budget, and a proposal for a part-time legislature. Margaret O'Brien, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We are speaking on Friday, so let's start with the female genital mutilation bills, which actually passed the House yesterday. Actually, there's a couple different sets of bills that have to go back and forth between the House and Senate. We heard about this particular case of three girls in Michigan who had this procedure had been done on. Is that what brought attention to this, or was this something that was on your radar before we heard that story?
Well, thank you for asking that, because, you know, many people have thought that at least the Senate package of bills was just because of the story. But actually, it was, I don't remember if it was in January or February, I had read some national article about female genital mutilation, and I didn't realize that this was something happening in the United States. So I started doing some research and had interest in this prior to the case that happened in Livonia. And I actually put in a bill request prior to the Livonia case asking for language on banning it. So for me, it started prior to this. The House package started once the Livonia case happened. I know there had been some legislators who had had interest in that, but I think that's what really had spurred them on. I'm optimistic that we can get this done prior to our summer work district period, because it's something really important we need to do. The federal penalties are so small. We really need to demand more to make sure we end this practice in Michigan.
And that was the reason that you wanted to make it a state crime, is because the federal penalties, in your view, don't meet what they should.
The federal penalties are only up to 5 years. And what you have is some states have laws on the book to ban this that have a higher penalty. So in the bills that we proposed and have passed the Senate and the House committee, we would make it a 15-year felony. And we think it's similar to second-degree criminal sexual conduct, so it's the same sentence. We think 5 years is way too small and way too light. And it's important to note that this practice is really a cultural practice, not a religious practice. So this happens in the Muslim faith, the Christian faith, the Jewish faith, and we tend to find its roots in third world countries. And so we really need to root out, it's not a religious-based practice. We need to really root it out, and it's very small groups in which this happens. It is absolutely horrific. It's really about controlling women, both psychologically and physically, and we need to make sure we stand up for the girls and the women and say no more, and definitely not in Michigan.
The bills that passed the House, there were just a couple of people who voted no. One of them was a Republican, Martin Hollerach, who raised concerns about the broad definition would cover some procedures legally done by plastic surgeons for those who are intersex or receiving gender reassignment surgery. Is there a legitimate concern about that?
You know, I talked to the representative, and I do not believe there is. We talked to reconstructive surgeons who have worked on this particular issue, and we have had no physician come to us and say that our language is wrong. And actually, in the Senate, we went through three different versions. We had the introduced version, and then we had three more versions because we were working with the medical community so that the language could be correct. So I believe anybody who's getting gender reassignment surgery, this does not stop it. If one really understands what female genital mutilation is, it's pretty horrendous. There is never a medical reason to do it, ever. And you know, probably in its tamest form, which is still horrifying to you and I, it's really about sewing the female vagina shut. And it's not like it's just a loose stitch that's on the outside. They go in a half inch in, and sew it shut. And on the wedding night, the husband gets to cut the wife open. That is at its tamest that I can describe it. So I do not see where the representative, where his concerns really were going to interface with that issue.
Let me ask you about the bills concerning prescription of opiates. There are people, of course, who have legitimate pain needs, but there's also a great concern about addiction. How do you balance those two things?
That is a great question, and I think that's why you see there's about 20 bills that have been introduced, and not all of them will pass. You know, I introduced three bills, not with the expectation that they pass, but with the expectation we're going to finally talk about things we haven't talked about. Two of the bills I partnered with Minority Leader Jim Ananick, Senator out of Flint, on, and those bills specifically target doctors who intentionally are writing prescriptions for addicts, and they're not for medical necessity, but rather they're fraudulent prescriptions. And we want to go after, make it a felony, strip the license from that physician. Now, are we saying this bill has to pass? No, but we do want to talk about, we know in Michigan, there are a handful of physicians who are writing the largest number of prescriptions for opioids. And it's not in relation to diagnoses in their area. And we think that we need to do a better job of enforcement. And if the state licensing board is not going to go after them, or their associations of which they're a member of are not going to go after them, then the state is going to put in our own law. So we just want to have the discussion. And we've had some wonderful discussions with physicians who also want it to stop. You know, another bill that I had introduced was, there is a opioid that has a deterrent in it, a prescription, so that you don't become addicted. It is more expensive. And the bill says the copays are going to be the same. Now, does it have to pass? No, but we want to force everyone to the table, the physician, the health insurance companies, the patients, about what is right for this person. If they have been an addict, why would we write them a prescription to something that's highly addictive when there is another drug out there that is not addictive that can take care of their pain? Wouldn't that save some treatment costs? So we want to start the conversations. Not all the bills will pass, but I'll tell you, we're having conversations we never had before.
You mentioned that this is kind of bringing people to the table, and maybe some of this legislation is not going to pass or get signed into law. But I guess I'm wondering, based on, you know, everything you've heard now, how big a problem do we have? And, you know, what are we talking about in terms of how big a solution we need?
That is probably the magic question. How big is the problem and what is the solution? The problem's pretty big. Michigan has led the nation in opioid deaths per capita. It is a severe problem, and it doesn't just impact one particular group. It's very widespread. What I appreciate with the physicians doing is they've really talked about how, you know, when we were talking about assisted suicide back when Jack Kevorkian was assisting people in that, the conversation became, a patient should never suffer. They should never have pain. And so pain became the quality measure of health care. Well, now pain is still the quality measure of health care. If your patient is in pain, it's deemed that there is a problem. We all know pain's a part of our life. Now, how do we manage pain, treat pain? But is it reasonable to expect that people will never be in pain? When I had foot surgery, I only wanted the pain meds that made my life manageable until I recovered from it. I never had the expectation I would be in no pain. And I can only imagine what I would have been on if my expectation had been, while recovering, I was in no pain. Because I was on a pretty high dose of Percocet. But I only wanted it so I could manage to get through every day and sleep a little bit at night. So I think we all have to readjust our thinking. And the physicians are really leading that conversation. And I appreciate what they're bringing to the table, because they're bringing to us, did you know that we are rated by the healthcare companies on if our people are in pain? If our people are in pain, it's considered bad.
And patient satisfaction surveys often include how much pain were you in, et cetera, those sort of things.
And it's heavily weighted towards pain. So if you would have surveyed me, yes, I was in pain, but I was managing my own pain. I never had the expectation of no pain. But if I would have gotten one of those surveys and answered, yes, I'm still in pain, my doctor could have gotten an unfavorable rating by the health insurance company.
And in theory, the next time they had a patient who had had foot surgery, they might be upping the doses in order to make sure that they don't get another quote-unquote unfavorable review.
Exactly. And that's where the push was. And the origins of that push were good. We did not want people who are terminally ill to be in pain. And it creeped into, we don't want anyone in everyday medicine being in pain. So I think we need to talk more. And my pain was very manageable because I knew going into my surgery what my expectations were, what the recovery would be like. So I wasn't surprised with the pain. I knew I'd had a great conversation with my physician. So I felt that my pain was very manageable. And, you know, hopefully this will open up the door for more conversations with our physicians. And it also will maybe bring more risk analysis. If they're going to give a prescription to somebody, have they been addicted to other things in the past? Are they at risk for becoming addictive to a heavy narcotic?
Let me ask you about the state budget. Apparently, there is a framework of an agreement around the teacher retirement system.
And let me back up here and ask you about this, because I had a conversation with a couple of people who cover the Capitol intently. They're there all the time, and they were a little surprised, I guess, that the teacher retirement system, MIPSERS as it's known, has become such an important part of this. You know, the Senate majority leader said that if there was not reform to this system, he wasn't sure when a state budget was going to get passed. Do you see reform of MIPSERS as a top priority?
I wish this were a simple answer. I do not see where anything needs to change to the teacher retirement fund that would hold up the budget. I understand the Senate Majority Leader's concerns that he wants to accommodate it in the budget, but I think it's a broader policy question. You know, when I got elected in 2011 to the State House, I was part of a group of freshmen who held up the budget in 2011 and said, we believe something has to be done to the teacher retirement system, MEPSERS. We knew there was a problem. We knew it was underfunded and schools were paying too much to put into the system. And so I've been part of that conversation since I first started in 2011. It wasn't until November or December of last year that people said there's a problem with the hybrid system. So let's just, for, because most people don't know this, including some of the people in our education system. Under Governor Granholm, the old 100% pension system ended and a hybrid system was created. So teachers could choose, do you want a part pension, part defined contribution plan, or do you want a total defined contribution plan? And so this hybrid retirement system came about. And most of the teachers picked the hybrid because, frankly, the 401k that's offered to them is horrible. It does not even equal what state employees are being given for their 401k. So they were essentially forced into the hybrid plan because it's simply better than the 401k. So it wasn't until November or December last year that anybody said, hey, the hybrid has a problem. I can't tell you if the hybrid has a problem yet or not. It was created in 2010. It was not even funded into the 2011-2012 budget because that's when it took effect. Not a single person is drawing retirement on it because it was only new enrollees that went in. So when we say there's a problem, we're projecting there may be a problem. I'm happy to go through that exercise. But more importantly, if we just simply offered a better 401k match like state employees get, let the teachers choose where they want to go. I believe most of them will choose the 401k system. Now, if we don't close out the hybrid and we just increase the 401k match and let teachers choose, I think the problem will take care of itself. I do think defined contribution in today's day and age allows people to be more mobile and not lose their retirement if they decide to change jobs. But I question the process and how we've gone about it and how it has to be directly linked to the budget. That's where I've probably had some disagreements with it. I'm always happy to discuss how we ensure that the promises made to the teachers are kept, but I don't want them to be political footballs.
Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly has proposed a ballot proposal, would amend the state constitution and make the legislature part-time. As someone who has now been there since 2011, has seen how it works in both the state house and the state senate, do you think that the legislature can get its work done in a 90-day window, which is what his proposal includes?
You know, I've always favored a part-time legislature, but the proposal that I had backed in the past was one that capped the number of days and also had capped the salary, but it wasn't so prescriptive in the 90 days. So I have not seen his proposal in writing because he's withdrawn it a couple times. But from what he has said, it's 90 consecutive days. Well, per the dictionary, consecutive means one after another. So are we going to expect our legislature Sunday through Saturday for 90 days to be in session? The lieutenant governor said it could be any 90 days. Well, the Constitution already prescribes which Wednesday in January both the House and the Senate must come to order. And according to his presentation of his proposal, that once we start session, we only have 90 days. So if we have to start on a particular Wednesday in January, then that means we will be done prior to April. So the expectation is we're going to do a budget. He has said that under his proposal, he wants a two-year budget. So we're going to have a shorter time period. We got to get 2 years of work done. Now, I'm going to tell you that we've had some particular challenges in the legislature. We've had the unemployment agency issue. We've had the Grand Rapids Veterans Home issue, and we've had the Flint water issue. Those did not rear their head in the first 90 days of the calendar year. So I am concerned about when the legislature is called upon to fix a crisis, which we have been called upon every time to fix it. We're the only ones that can decide to fund. The governor gets to propose. We get to dispose. We get to say yes or no, or come up with our own solution. And so I'm concerned about, what about emergencies? And does that put the executive in too much power the way this is written, so that they could maybe hide an emergency and we would be powerless? So what's that going to mean? But then second, we need to have an honest conversation. I don't like it when I'm told I only work 90 days a year. We might only have between 90 to 110 session days a year. Today is not a session day. I started my first appointment at 9 a.m. I will have met nonstop without a single bathroom break until 4 o'clock today. And this is an early day. Most days I start very early. I'm usually up at 5 a.m. on the road prior to 6, not at home till 9 or 10 at night. So I don't think it's fair
even
to
even
say.
Even when you're not in session.
Even when I'm not in session. Look at all the community events we are blessed to have. People want us there. If I'm only going to get paid for working 90 days, so are you, you're saying you expect me to have another job to support my family. Are you then still expecting me to work 7 days a week? Because there are events going on in our community 7 days a week that I go to. Are you expecting me to work 7 days a week and somehow fitting that in with another job? I mean, I don't think we're having a transparent conversation with the voters. A part-time legislature means we're not working 7 days a week anymore. We're not working around the clock anymore. And I'm okay with that. But when you try to say I'm only going to work 90 days and we're going to do it here, I have talked about so many diverse issues this morning that I don't know when those people would get to see me if I only work 90 days. Because I'm going to be, it's Friday. It's a work day. And then what employer is going to give me 90 consecutive days off? Teachers will not be allowed to run for legislature. They're going to miss 90 of their 180 days of instruction. So are we going to be shutting it out? I back a part-time legislature. I think it needs to be more thoughtful and more inclusive so more people can run, but you're also not just blanketing out, you're shutting out the community entirely from their elected body.
Do you think that if there is a move to a part-time legislature, that that should be coupled with some sort of lengthening of term limits? That's a concern that some lawmakers have raised, that already we have only a really few people up there right now who have been in the legislature for any length of time to develop some expertise. A lot of lawmakers say they rely heavily on, say, the House and Senate fiscal agencies. So, I mean, if there's going to be a move to a part-time legislature, should lawmakers be given some more time to serve in the state House and Senate?
I think that is something we should look at. I'm going to give you an example in my first year. So in my first year, I was right in saying we had to address the unfunded liabilities in the teacher pension system. I was absolutely right on the issue. And in fact, it was a group of freshmen who hijacked our budget and demanded action. We were right. Where we were wrong was the solution that year. We thought we knew what we were talking about because we had researched it. We had investigated it. And our proposal was, let's give the schools an extra per pupil allotment of money to buy down what they were having to put in. So that's how we chose to fund the system. After that got passed and signed by the governor, we learned to our horror that we had not funded any of the liabilities of any of the educators at our ISDs, our intermediate school districts. They're not funded on a per pupil basis. So this happened in June. So I had 6 months to identify my issue, research the issue, and come up with a solution to solve this problem. And yet in 6 months, I found the wrong solution.
To fix it again.
I had to fix it again. And that came at my local superintendent at the time, Ron Fuller, was head of KRESA. And he was like, Margaret, I love what you were doing, which was tackling this problem. Did you just realize we still had all that liability? You did nothing to help us. And so then by the next year, I was prepared for a better solution. Within 3 months, would I have identified the problem and the solution? I don't know. I can guarantee I wouldn't have found the right solution because I didn't find it in 6 months. And with a 2-year budget, it would have been 2 years of creating this disparity amongst educators, depending how they were funded. And so I've learned a lot, and in the Senate, people tend to vote their representatives into the Senate. So the Senate tends to have experience. Whoever the governor is hires experience. They hire former legislators, former department directors. The house is the one with constant turnover. And I can tell you from being someone in the house who had identified the right problem and came up with the wrong solution, we need to do more to have an equal playing field with the house so that they're not always left with a little bit less expertise. So I do worry about over-reliance on staff and on lobbyists, neither of which are elected.
Margaret O'Brien, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
State Senator Margaret O'Brien is a Republican. She represents Kalamazoo County in the Michigan Senate. A longer version of the interview with Margaret O'Brien, including her thoughts on bills proposed to toughen penalties on animal cruelty and to give restaurants the option and guidelines for allowing dogs on outdoor patios, can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A task force was appointed last year to study the idea of starting a local ID program for Kalamazoo County. A report is expected soon. Earlier this year, Sevilla Mann spoke with Keita Cowan, the CEO of Synod Services in Ypsilanti. Cowan's group helped create the local ID program in Washtenaw County. She spoke via Skype for an interview that originally aired in January.
Keita Cowan, welcome to West Southwest.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to a driver's license or some other kind of state ID, what are some of the reasons that a person might struggle to get one?
One of the first reasons people have difficulty accessing identification through the state is that the state system is predicated on the presence of a birth certificate, and many folks don't have birth certificates. That can stem from a number of reasons. Files are lost, records are misplaced. Older African Americans, particularly from the South, never had a birth certificate because their births weren't deemed worthy of recording. And then more recently in Michigan, the Secretary of State instituted a policy that folks needed to prove that they were in the state and in the country legally in order to qualify for a state ID card or driver's license. And that excluded thousands of undocumented residents who prior to 2008 had been able to access both a state ID card and a driver's license in Michigan.
So it can be a lack of paperwork, it can be because you're an immigrant but undocumented.
That's correct. I'm sorry, I just wanted to add that I didn't talk about homeless folks who don't have proof of residency in the state because the Secretary of State looks for documents that basically are attached to a home life. So they look for utility records, which you don't have if you're homeless.
What about if you've just been released from prison or jail? Do you does that present any problems for getting a state ID?
Oftentimes now, returning citizens are released without being given either the identification that they entered prison with, nor are they given a new ID card or driver's license when they are released from prison. A lot of folks have been released with just the Michigan Department of Corrections identification card, and the Secretary of State is reluctant to accept those.
Is it likely to be just a handful of people in a community who can't get a state ID?
Well, there's a study that was conducted by the Brennan Center of Justice out of the NYU School of Law, that approximately 11% of all citizens in the United States lack photo ID.
We mentioned before that you might need an ID for applying for a job or opening a bank account. I'm guessing that's just scratching the surface. What are some of the other things you might be excluded from if you don't have an ID?
One of the largest issues in Washtenaw County back in 2014, when the community conversation first evolved about lack of ID, was centered around housing. You now need to, you know, basically produce an ID card in order to rent an apartment, and people without ID are therefore excluded. Employment, you can't complete the I-9 form without proof of identity, and so you don't have the right to work. You need an ID card. Everyone's aware that you need an ID to travel by plane, but a lot of folks aren't aware that both Amtrak and Greyhound require ID, so transportation becomes an issue.
quite a range of things that you could be entirely cut off from if you don't have some kind of ID card.
Oh, yes. And people are most desperate to get an ID when they have children because you can't pick your child up from school without an ID card.
Really?
And everyone, yes. And everyone knows that you need an ID to access library resources.
And so if I'm going to apply for a card in Washtenaw, what do I have to do to prove to the county that I am who I say I am?
We've established an objective 300-point verification system that requires, that was established in a manner that allocates a certain number of points to each type of identity credential that you might present. So, for instance, a passport is given a certain number of points. An employer ID is given a certain number of points. A Michigan Department of Corrections ID is allocated a certain number of points. And you need to produce 300 points worth of identity credentials in order to qualify for an identification card. That's the first step. And then the second step is that you need to prove residency.
Once you've decided to issue a local ID, do you still have to get banks and libraries and employers and local governments to sign on? I'm guessing there isn't a legal mechanism for compelling those institutions to recognize the ID?
Well, there is no requirement that a particular institution even recognize a state ID card.
Oh, okay.
So let's start there. Every agency and institution is free to recognize state, federal, and local ID. We worked, before we instituted the program, we worked with law enforcement and other major community institutions so that everyone was on the same page and could agree to accept the identification card as it was being developed. So that's work that had to be done in advance of starting the program.
Did you have anybody raise concerns about costs or confidentiality? Were there some concerns you had to address?
Definitely. When we were developing the program, there were questions about the confidentiality of the database in which names and identities are recorded. But what the community reminded us of is that back in 2008 and before, when, for instance, undocumented folks could access state ID cards and driver's licenses, people were willing to, you know, have their names listed in the state database. And so the idea of being listed in a database wasn't foreign, and folks felt that the county, with its commitment to preserving the confidentiality of the information, made them feel even more secure than they felt when they were in the state database. So it wasn't a new idea, I guess I would say.
And how about the cost to the county of creating the program? I imagine on the one hand, it's not a big expense. On the other hand, sometimes you hear government leaders say, I like that idea, but how do I justify the cost?
Well, the cost depends on the level of equipment that the type of equipment and the level of equipment that you purchase. Washtenaw County, I believe our equipment costs somewhere around $50,000. And that seemed reasonable. I know, given the benefits that we're going to accrue both to the community as a whole and to individuals, it really was a pittance when you think about children having access to the library, creating a level playing field, when you think about homeless folks having access to employment where before they didn't, the cost seems very reasonable.
Keita Cowan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Keita Cowan is the CEO of Synod Community Services in Ypsilanti. We spoke by Skype about why some communities have created local ID cards. You can hear a longer version of this interview at our website. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.
A version of the interview with Keita Cowan originally aired in January. Join us again on Thursday for the next edition of WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.